You're listening to SBS News.
We're under invasion from within.
It's completely unacceptable to see fat generals and admirals in the halls of the Pentagon.
You shut down government and make life harder and more expensive? That is insane.
Europe must deliver a strong and united response to Russia's drone incursions at our borders.
This can be done the easy way, or it can be done the hard way, but it will be done.
Welcome to World News Weekly, and a big hello to our international chief correspondent, Ben Lewis. It's great to be back, Ben. Did I miss much?
No, just a little bit of world news. Kat, it is great to have you back, and I hope we can fill the void of Claudia's absence.
Indeed.
She's off stuck in a typhoon this week.
Lucky her. Speaking of typhoons, you're fresh off a stint at the UN General Assembly in New York, which seemed to create its own major weather event. It was hardly smooth sailing from what I've seen. I mean, escalator gate. Need I say more?
Yeah, you wouldn't want to be the person to be to blame for the escalator, would you? It stopped working as President Donald Trump was about halfway up. I checked out the escalator. It seemed like a normal escalator to me. Mm. And the UN tells us that it was actually a member of Trump's team who triggered the emergency stop mechanism. So it was kind of his fault.
Yikes. We'll speak more about the highs and lows of the UN General Assembly in a minute, plus the peace plan for Gaza.
And an astonishing speech by Trump and his Secretary of War, I'm still not used to saying that, to the country's top generals.
Getting back to the UN General Assembly, let's do a bit of a recap from last week. I want to talk climate first. It got a little lost with all the recognising of a Palestinian state going on. It was, however, one of the items on Trump's long speech calling climate change a con job. But perhaps on a more optimistic note, we saw China make its first ever concrete commitment to curb emissions by 7 to 10% from its peak level by 2035. Was there a sense the dial had moved at all, Ben?
Yeah, interestingly, I actually spoke to a few people from the Pacific delegations who said, look, this is good, but not enough. And it still stands out, though, in stark contrast to what we heard from President Trump, the whole biggest con job in history line from him. So China is trying to present itself as the global leader in this with strong investment in renewables. However, it still emits a third of the world's greenhouse gases. Now, new targets unveiled by countries ahead of the COP30 summit in November were interesting, but developing countries say climate funding by wealthy nations still doesn't go far enough.
Yeah, and there were some notable appearances as well. North Korea's Vice President Kim Song-un insisting North Korea will never give up its nuclear program, and it's something that South Korea's new leader says it would go along with. And then, of course, a speech from Syrian interim president Ahmed al-Sharaa, the first Syrian leader to speak in nearly 60 years at the conference.
Yeah, that was actually a really fascinating moment. On the way into the UN, he walked on the streets of New York, as most of the sort of the lower level, to put it politely, leaders do. And he was mobbed by people supporting him. He looked actually quite emotional. And it's an incredible story. I mean, he was once a jihadist fighter. There was a $10 million US bounty out on his head, and now he's at the United Nations shaking hands with Marco Rubio and making speeches talking about the importance of diplomacy and never turning to violence. So pretty extraordinary moment.
Yeah, and another extraordinary moment that we can't ignore is Benjamin Netanyahu's speech. There was a mass walkout before the Israeli Prime Minister even began to speak. Let's play out a bit of that moment.
Please. Order in the hall. Please, order in the hall.
What was the atmosphere like in the room, Ben?
Frosty, in a word. There was the coordinated walkout at the start of the speech. To be fair, this was on the Friday, and by the time you get to this stage of the week, most of the leaders have gone home. It's a pretty empty room anyway. Benjamin Netanyahu would have known he would have been speaking to no one in the room, really. His address was really targeted at the domestic market back home and to your Trump-supporting Republicans in the United States watching Fox News. Those were the two key audiences he was looking at. I mean, he had props. He had the giant QR code badge on his lapel where people could scan it and get information about the attacks on October 7. And then there was sort of a stunt in Gaza, if you would, where the Israeli military were blasting his speech through huge speakers into Gaza, and he spoke directly to the hostages at one point and directly to the Hamas leaders, urging them to lay down their weapons. Look, everything he said, no one was particularly surprised by what he said. He had some very harsh words for Anthony Albanese and other leaders who'd used the General Assembly to recognise an independent Palestinian state, but that completely empty room, the walkout, just another visual representation, I guess, showing how much more isolated Israel is in the world after the last couple of years. After his UN speech, Netanyahu went to DC to meet President Trump, who unveiled a 20-point peace plan. Some of the key elements being ending the war immediately, the release of all hostages within 72 hours, and then Israel will release 250 life sentence prisoners plus 1,700 Gazans held by Israel. Full humanitarian aid going into Gaza, Hamas disarming and a staged withdrawal of Israeli troops, a temporary administration to govern Gaza, enter Tony Blair there, oversight by a, quote, board of peace chaired by Trump, and a vague reference to redevelopment and reform, which could lead to a viable pathway for an independent Palestinian state. But Netanyahu has already said he would fight that. Now, there's a lot to unpack there, even without adding all the other elements in. It has pretty widespread support among the international community, including Arab states, but there are certainly questions around how the terms and conditions will be implemented.
Hamas have said the proposal is heavily weighted in Israel's favour, but they will consider it. President Trump has given them 3 to 4 days to make a decision. Hamas members are being offered safe passageway if they wish to leave Gaza, and amnesty for those who decommission their weapons and commit to peace. But they would have to accept that they will have no role in the future of Gaza, something they've been unwilling to countenance up to now. Joining us is The Economist's Middle East correspondent, Greg Karlstrom from Doha. Thanks so much for joining us, Greg.
Thanks for having me.
I guess, first off, what do Palestinians think of this proposal?
I think, by and large, people in Gaza, at least my sense, is they would like it to be implemented. And that is despite the fact that they have some very real reservations about this proposal. I mean, it was drafted essentially without any Palestinian input. It's the product of meetings that Donald Trump had with Arab leaders at the UN last week, and then subsequent discussions with the Israeli government. The Palestinians have really had very little say in this. And so even for people who are not members of Hamas or supporters of Hamas, they have concerns about, for example, the language around an international board being put in charge of reconstruction in Gaza. And they have concerns about, you know, what role will Palestinians have in their own governance. But notwithstanding all of that, after 2 years of horrific and devastating war in Gaza, I think it's safe to say that most people there want it to end. And if this plan is the most realistic way to end it, they want this plan to be implemented.
Greg, it seems like Benjamin Netanyahu is only going to take part of this deal to cabinet for approval, focusing on the hostages and prisoner swap. Can hardline ministers in the government like Smotrich and Ben-Gvir still derail it?
They can't block it in a sort of technical political sense. Netanyahu does have to have a vote on the hostage deal provision, because part of that arrangement is that Israel has to release Palestinian prisoners in return, and the release of prisoners requires a vote from the cabinet under Israeli law. The rest of it, the prime minister can push through unilaterally. Now, the risk for him is political. The risk for him is that if he pushes through a deal that his far-right partners don't want, some of them might leave the coalition and might trigger an early election. I think were that to happen, Netanyahu would still temporarily have some support from outside the government, from the opposition that has said it will back him for a brief period of time, as long as is needed to implement or start implementing a ceasefire and a hostage deal. They've promised to give him support from the outside. But there is, I think, a real risk here for the prime minister that, you know, if he says yes to this deal, if it is implemented, Israel will head for early elections in the spring.
And Trump said that if Hamas fails to accept the proposal, the operation will continue in, quote, terror-free areas. handed over from the Israeli military to an interim stabilization force. And Trump has given his blessing to Israel to essentially annihilate Hamas if they fail to cooperate. How would that be different to the situation now, Greg?
The past few weeks or the past few months, we've all been talking about this Israeli offensive in Gaza City that Netanyahu has ordered. Tens of thousands of troops are meant to go into the largest city in Gaza and essentially conquer it and then hold it in perpetuity. That's how Netanyahu has talked up the operation. What we've seen in practice is that Eyal Zamir, the army chief, has been reluctant to go ahead with a large-scale ground offensive in the entirety of Gaza City. Israeli troops have pushed into some of the villages or suburbs almost on the outskirts of Gaza City. There's been very heavy aerial bombardment of the city as well, but we haven't seen this big, you know, three-division offensive that was talked up earlier this year. I think if this deal fails, if negotiations are unsuccessful, that offensive will go ahead in earnest. We will see the remaining 500,000 people living in Gaza City probably displaced, forced to flee further south. We will see Israeli troops moving into the heart of Gaza City in a way that they really haven't thus far. And then there's a possibility after that the Israeli army will turn its attention to central and southern Gaza, to the densely populated refugee camps and the other areas where people have been displaced, and perhaps try to mount a ground offensive there as well.
And Greg, the rebuilding and reform part of this plan seems pretty vague and sort of quite a lofty statement. We heard Smotrich, the finance minister, just last week saying there were plans to divide up Gaza for redevelopment and that they're on President Trump's desk and being actively discussed. How plausible is it that after all these years of trying, this could actually happen?
Everything to do with the day after the war is vague. It's basically a collection of bullet points right now, and there are competing visions of what the next era for Gaza will look like. There are Arab states that have been drawing up plans for months now for reconstruction that would keep Palestinians in their homes in Gaza or rebuild their homes. You have European countries that have been involved in those efforts, and then you have these sort of far-right Israeli fever dreams of displacing the entire population and rebuilding settlements there. Now, the plan that Trump talked up earlier this week, it certainly sounds closer to the Arab proposals. It says very clearly that no one will be forced to leave Gaza, although the plan says if people want to leave, they should be able to make that choice voluntarily. It talks up this International Board of Peace, as it's called, to oversee reconstruction. But who is actually going to do the reconstruction work on the ground? Who is going to pay for it? What is the timetable going to be? We just don't have a clear answer to any of that yet.
And Greg, from looking over the 20-point plan, is there anything that you really see that kind of sticks out to you as missing from the proposal?
I think the other thing, I think what's missing in general is just specifics. I think there's some very sensible ideas in there, but they're almost one-sentence ideas. I think the other thing that is likely to be an issue, either something that might sink the negotiations over this proposal in the coming weeks, or something that might be a long-term issue, is the question of how you disarm Hamas. The group is meant to relinquish its weapons under this proposal. I find it very hard to see them agreeing to that. And even if they agree to it sort of in theory, on paper, I'm very skeptical that in practice they would agree to be disarmed. And so what is meant to happen is there's meant to be some sort of international peacekeeping force that comes into Gaza and compels Hamas to disarm. But who is going to join that peacekeeping force? I mean, I was speaking with one of the negotiators earlier this week who told me no country has yet volunteered to join that force. Nobody in the Arab world certainly is that eager to send troops into a situation where they might end up in conflict with Hamas. So I think there's a big unanswered question around disarmament, because at some point, if Hamas is not disarmed, either it's going to be able to spoil whatever sort of post-war plans you have in Gaza, or there's a chance of yet another round of conflict with Israel.
Thanks so much for joining us, Greg. It's been great to hear your perspective on all of this.
Thanks for having me.
Gaza isn't the only place President Trump is promising to straighten out. He just made a speech to the US military's top brass, summoned from all corners of the globe, to tell them the enemy is within.
We're under invasion from within. No different than a foreign enemy, but more difficult in many ways because they don't wear uniforms. At least when they're wearing a uniform, you can take them out. These people don't have uniforms. But we are under invasion from within. We're stopping it very quickly.
It's not the first time Trump has made comments like this, but saying it to a room full of MAGA supporters is a little bit different from saying it to a room full of military commanders. And to help put that in context, we're joined by Bruce Wolpe, Senior Fellow at the US Studies Center. Bruce, thank you for coming back on the pod.
Great to be with you. Thank you so much.
This seems like a pretty remarkable moment, telling the US military that the threat is within. Is it as bad as it seems?
Yes, because I think it is a shock for the commander-in-chief to say such a thing to all the assembled generals. And people actually can't recall when all the generals across the armed forces of the United States and around the world have convened in one place, Quantico, Virginia. You just wonder how many people were thinking about, wow, I wish I could get a bomb in there. To listen to the Secretary of War and the President of the United States. And it is just thinking back on Trump's first term, when he wanted to use military force against protesters across the country, particularly in the wake of George Floyd's murder, and that it was the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Milley, who said, no, Mr. President, you can't do that. Milley felt bad. Remember, they walked out of the White House. There was a church that was burning a bit in Lafayette Square, and Milley was photographed in uniform, fatigues, walking with the president. And afterwards, he said, I was not comfortable with that. I felt used. It's not my role. It's not what the military does. And so he broke with Trump over that issue. That issue never left for Trump. And he intends, as we have seen from the deployment of troops in Los Angeles, troops in Washington, coming soon to Memphis, Tennessee, coming soon to Portland, Oregon. He has no qualms about it. But in addressing it in this way, the enemy within, then it's troops against the American people. And even if anyone who commits crimes against the United States should pay for those crimes, but who enforces it? And so he's in new territory. And again, the generals have not heard that that is a mission of theirs formally from their commander in chief.
Can Trump expect his generals and admirals to accept this domestic threat as part of their job? He is, after all, commander-in-chief.
I don't think we'll have resignations following that meeting. I think people will absorb it and then just see how things play out. And Trump is term limited. He has 3 years left. So that's in the back of their minds. But I still think this is a moment of some surprise and discomfort across the ranks. So there is a lot of turmoil here. But the generals are professional and they know their jobs. The chairman of the Joint Chiefs, General Dan Kane, he says Raisin Kane, that's what I call him. He and Trump do work well together. Think of the strike on Iran. It was very exceptionally well executed. And I think he knows what he's dealing with and what the limits are and how you can still have a very effective military. So disquiet, concern, but I don't see any dramatic shakeup immediately.
President Trump is now sending the National Guard into another Democrat-controlled city, this time beautiful Portland in Oregon. When the governor called him to say, look, there's no problem here, the president seemed surprised that the reality was different from what he'd seen on TV, thought to be due to a montage he'd watched on Fox News that included some file footage of riots. Is the US president really that isolated, or do you think this is more confusion by design?
Don't confuse me with the facts. I mean, he has things in his head. He never changes his mind when he's made up how much money we've given to Ukraine or other things. He just sticks with those facts and figures. So it's in his head, again, going back to the George Floyd riots in Seattle and in Portland and in Minneapolis. He saw things and he really wanted the troops, and in Washington, D.C., and he wanted the troops there. So he will not be dissuaded. But I think what people are afraid of is if this, let's say there are very serious unrest in cities and he sends troops in and people are killed. I think that then becomes a literal flashpoint in events and politics.
For too long, we've promoted too many uniformed leaders for the wrong reasons, based on their race, based on gender quotas. We became the woke department, but not anymore. No more beardos. The era of rampant and ridiculous shaving profiles is done. To our enemies, F-A-F-O.
So the event was a double act. That was the Secretary of War, Pete Hegseth, basically calling time on what he says is an overly woke military. Pretty strong words from Hegseth, some aimed at the generals themselves. The Army has spent decades trying to become more inclusive, one imagines sometimes against their will. Did he have a captive audience, do you think, Bruce?
He had a captive audience. They do answer to him. And he, as you can see from watching him deliver these remarks, this is very passionate stuff. It's really inside him. It is the reason, what he articulates is the reason why Trump was comfortable with him being Secretary of Defense, now Secretary of War. And he wanted to leave no one in doubt as to what the mission is, what the rules are, how they're going to be evaluated. And I thought, just from his point of view, I thought it was very powerful. And I think he accomplished what he wanted to accomplish. So, yeah, he's there. And he had the backing of the president. The president was, spoke after him. So pretty strong stuff.
He was talking about it, generals having to be able to do pull-ups as well. I'm not sure the commander-in-chief would be able to do that. Bruce, the military is a huge part of American life, of course. Do you think that these changes will have an impact on the broader population and the country's politics? I mean, it is a huge force. So many military families in the US that will be affected by this.
Well, I think people of color, I think women have been looking at what's happened since they took power. And really, there have been a thinning of ranks among both demographics.
Today marks day one of the Schumer shutdown.
The reason why the American people's government is shut down is because Chuck Schumer is listening to the far left radicals in his own party.
Donald Trump and the Republicans own this shutdown.
We want this government open, and we want Donald Trump and his minions to stop lying to the American public.
The US has also just gone into what's called shutdown when Congress can't agree to extend a bill for federal funding. It's happened plenty of times before, particularly in Trump's first term, once lasting at 35 days at a cost of $3 billion to GDP. Tens of thousands of federal workers won't get paid during a shutdown, and Trump has said he will take the opportunity to lay off thousands of them and cut programs that benefit Democrats. Bruce, what is the significance of all this?
It's huge because this is really a political fight. I mean, it's a fight on issues, but it's also a political fight. Who has the upper hand? And we see the Democrats doing this, even though there's a lot of risk. I mean, as this shutdown gets underway, it's clear the Democrats triggered it. They wanted to trigger it. Will they take the blame for all those adverse consequences that you laid out? And there's a big risk that actually they will. But they believe first that the issue is so important that the American people understand it. In December, health insurance premiums under Obamacare will double for 22 million people. That is a big hit of thousands of dollars a year. And most of the people who buy it are small business people and just regular working families who don't have health insurance through their employers. So that's why the issue is so hot. As far as, but there's going to be an added kicker aside from just reducing the government being closed, that the Office of Management and Budget does want to fire tens of thousands of more workers. Just they want to complete the job that Elon Musk was doing. And that was not popular. Everyone knows a government worker, and a lot of people have lost their jobs. And so if you're in a neighborhood and your friends lost their jobs because of what Trump, well, that doesn't sit very well. Plus services aren't delivered. Plus the economy takes a slowdown and Trump doesn't need that. So While the Democrats feel, yeah, we're going to ultimately get the edge here, there's huge cost to everyone involved, and Trump may still win the argument because this misery has not been inflicted by me.
Yeah, and, there's always a lot of finger-pointing in these situations, as you just touched on. Who do you think will come off to blame?
It really depends on how it's settled. If ultimately this goes on, I think this will go on for at least a week, 10 days, but if it goes on for much longer, and people will decide, well, who's stopping us from resolving this? And if the Democrats are seen as just selfish and mindless and they have one talking point, healthcare, and in the meantime, all this misery is inflicted, I think they get blamed. If Trump is seen as being obstinate, People look to a president to lead and solve problems, not lead and create problems. So if Trump is seen as being unreasonable, ultimately the blame will shift to him. Now, he triggered a shutdown in 2018 to 19. It went for 4 or 5 weeks, and he was blamed for that. Nothing was resolved, and he ultimately retreated. So the question is, who retreats from this? We'll know the answer to that probably in about 10 days.
Thanks so much for joining us once again on the pod, Bruce.
Fantastic. Thanks to you both.
You asked this question about tomahawks. It's something the president's going to make the final determination on. What the president is going to do is what's in the best interest of the United States of America.
U.S. Vice President J.D. Vance there confirming that U.S. President Donald Trump is considering Ukraine's request for long-range missiles in the form of tomahawks. This would signal a significant shift in Trump's support for Ukraine beyond his changing rhetoric. Trump's claim that Ukraine could win back its territory from Russia is definitely a departure from his previous assertions that Ukraine will have to cede territory to end the war, Ben.
Yeah, Kat, there'll be quite a few officials in Kyiv enjoying the fact that J.D. Vance has had to go out there and defend Donald Trump's new Ukraine position. President Trump hasn't signed off on any deal yet, but Moscow is already declaring that any move in this direction would be, wait for it, crossing a red line. There's a lot of red lines from the Kremlin. Something Russia has said repeatedly when it comes to Western allies offering any increase in support for Ukraine. This is despite the fact Russia simultaneously says it's unconcerned by the long-range missiles, insisting they wouldn't be a game-changer for the war, but raising questions around who will operate and have the authority to launch them. Now, up till now, allies have limited the range of missiles they've provided to Ukraine to a few hundred kilometres, precisely over concerns of escalation. Tomahawk cruise missiles have a range of 2,500 kilometres. And while Ukraine has used drones to great effect deep in Russian territory, cruise missiles, of course, pack a far bigger punch and they're a lot harder to shoot down.
Yeah, and it comes at an interesting point in the conflict, doesn't it? Because we're seeing NATO ramp up its defences after a series of Russian provocations. There have been repeated reports of drone and fighter jet incursions as well as hybrid attacks. The drones that shut down Danish airports being blamed on Russia most recently.
Yeah, Russia's probably already testing NATO. Moscow argues it's already fighting against Russia. It does at least appear that Russia's trying to send a warning to Western nations that Moscow isn't willing to back down in its war on Ukraine and possibly seeing if it can get NATO more focused on its own protection than Ukraine's. Interestingly, the other day I was sitting in a press conference with Sergei Lavrov, the Russian foreign minister. He was asked directly about the drones and he said, no, 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 not us. He was smirking.
Time to take a look at some other big stories falling under the radar around the globe. A decisive victory for Moldova's pro-EU party in spite of an alleged massive campaign of vote buying and interference from Russia, something confirmed by the EU observers.
That's right. The pro-Russian party, the patriotic electoral bloc, only secured around 24% of votes in the end, compared to President Maia Sandu's PAS, the Party of Action and Solidarity, which managed to get just over 50% of votes, a better outcome than expected by Western nations and by PAS themselves. But barriers do remain for Sandu's goal of entering the European Union.
And the UN has reimposed sanctions on Iran for the first time in a decade after nuclear talks with Western powers failed to produce a breakthrough. The sweeping measures include an arms embargo and a freeze on global assets, as well as a ban on uranium enrichment.
The UK, France and Germany accused Iran of violating the terms of a 2015 nuclear agreement and triggered the deal's so-called snapback mechanism. Iran has dismissed the sanctions as unlawful and has recalled its ambassadors to those E3 countries. The measures are likely to further squeeze Iran's economy, which is already struggling under heavy US sanctions.
And to Madagascar, where President Andry Rajoelina has dissolved the government following days of youth-led demonstrations. Inspired by similar Gen Z protests in Kenya, Nepal and Indonesia, thousands of young people took to the streets in cities across the country to rally against long-standing water and power cuts. The UN says at least 22 people were killed and dozens more injured during the demonstrations.
Madagascar now finds itself on a growing list of countries that have been rattled recently by mass protests of predominantly young people demanding political reform. In Morocco, violent clashes broke out between security forces and protesters following days of demonstrations. Young people there are demanding urgent investment in public health care and education. Meanwhile, authorities in Peru say at least 19 people were injured during anti-government rallies in the capital over the weekend, where young Peruvians marched alongside transport workers to protest against corruption and organised crime.
Ben, I've got a question for you. Have you been throwing shade online recently?
I don't know if I have or I haven't, because I don't know what that means.
I'll translate it into old people language, no offence. It basically means complaining on the internet. So if you do indulge in negative attitudes online and you have any plans to reside in China for whatever reason, watch out, because you might be wiped. The Chinese government is taking direct aim at an emotion increasingly common across the country's internet, pessimism. Authorities have launched a campaign to, quote, rectify negative emotions and create a civilised online environment.
See, this is why I live in London, because in Britain, pessimism is celebrated. Yeah. It's like the national emotion.
Yep, you belong there then. Don't go to China, all right? A week ago, Hu Shenfeng, one of China's most popular content creators, had all his content mysteriously vanish. People are speculating it follows a viral comment he made categorising people as either Apple or Android, the latter being inferior, just so you know. Experts are suggesting that such jokes draw attention to social divides the Chinese Communist Party would rather avoid discussion around.
So it's essentially a two-month campaign being launched to crack down on whingers.
Yep, basically. And I love the irony of this. It's basically a bunch of old dudes trying to sabotage the entire purpose of the internet, i.e. whinging. Classic cat police, as the kids would say, Ben.
I do know what cat means.
Do you?
Cat means lying. Why is everyone writing me off here?
You know, like, I just wasn't expecting you to be so down with the kids, Ben.
Yeah, no, I've got all that skibbity toilet riz. Isn't that what they say?
Yeah, sure. And that's the world this week. Don't forget to like and subscribe to our pod wherever you listen. New episodes will drop every Thursday. Catch you next time, Ben.
See you, Kat.